Marks of Time. Did you keep pace with the news of the year?
What great loyalist victory changed all Italy's plans in Spain?
As the U.S. financial barometer danced crazily downward in late 1937, what happened to business in Europe?
Did the special session of Congress pass any one of President Roosevelt's must reforms?
What newly discovered drug offered sudden hope of conquering four great scourges of mankind?
What part have Italy and Germany played in Japan's invasion of China?
On these and 100 similar questions, 2 million readers of Time, the weekly news magazine, will test their knowledge of current events tomorrow. For tomorrow's new issue of Time includes Time's famous semi-annual test on current events. This is not a special test on Time for Time readers only. It is a general current events test prepared by two famous educators and used in hundreds of schools and colleges all over the country.
But the chances are that Time readers will again make far better grades than their Time-less neighbors. For Time tells all the news a busy, intelligent man or woman needs to know or remember. Time tells it so briefly that you can read it in a single fascinating evening. Tells it so clearly that it is easy to understand. Tells it so vividly that you can't help remembering it.
So, buy a copy of Time, the weekly news magazine, on the newsstand tomorrow. For you will find it fun to test your own and your friends' knowledge of current events on Time's famous semi-annual current events test.
Again tonight, Life, the weekly magazine of pictures, joins Time, the weekly news magazine, in presenting the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From the marks of Time. Valentine's Day, 9 a.m., in the switchboard room of the New York office of Postal Telegraph.
I tried again, Miss Trout. Okay, you'll do. Just a stunt, of course. You'll probably only have a dozen calls all day. But from now on, you're head of the singing Valentine department.
Well, all right, Mr. Schuyler. I'll do my best.
Thus, this week, U.S. Enterprise experiments with a holiday innovation, the singing Valentine. But by 10 o'clock in the office of Postal Press Agent Philip Schuyler...
Hello?
Mrs. Schuyler, this thing is getting out of hand.
What is?
Well, 14 calls for singing Valentine's in the past 10 minutes.
Great. Take 20 more girls off the switchboard.
But they can't sing.
Oh,
they
never
don't
mind that. Put them on anyway. I'll get the story to the papers. We'll put on a release.
Singing Valentine's crack the noon editions. Customers demand Valentine's sung by tenors, baritones, bassos. Noon, a home in Colorado Springs.
Hello?
Oh, dear Valentine, I send you this line. Oh, will you be mine, sweet
this?
Valentine? Signed, Bob, by permission of the copyright owners of By Mere Mr. Shane. This is a Postal Telegraph Valentine.
...3 p.m. in the office of a Chicago radio executive.
Hello? Hello?
Sweetheart.
I'm sorry, Toots. If you want an audition, you'll have to write me a letter.
Oh, no, sir. This is Postal Telegraph giving a Valentine. Sweetheart.
By late afternoon, 30 more operators are singing for Postal Telegraph. 60,000 singing Valentines have already been delivered. And toward Valentine's Day's end comes the final triumph for Postal Press Agent Philip Schuyler.
Hello?
Mr. Schuyler, Miss Trout, there's one for London.
London, England?
Yes, to Evelyn Hobson.
Oh, no, my dear, it's called Evelyn over there. Well, put a special man on it. No, wait a minute. I'll sing it to her myself. Put the call through to me.
Go ahead, London.
London, England.
Are you there?
Is Miss Evelyn Hobson there, please?
This is Evelyn Hobson.
Will you have her come to the... You're Evelyn Hobson?
Yes. What do you want?
Well, I love you truly, truly, dear.
This week, U.S. Wire Services report their most profitable Valentine's Day on record, with delivery of 81,491 singing Valentines, with at least one postal operator offered a radio contract. with Western Union retaliating by sending a telephoto facsimile of lipstick kiss imprinted on telegraph blanks, with a Manhattan socialite having himself delivered by messenger in a heart-shaped cardboard box. 1938 marches on. From the eastern seaboard of the Carolinas to the Mississippi River and beyond extends the cotton belt, a black strip of fertile soil that is the mainspring of the South's agricultural economy. Dominated for more than a century by the plantation system, the cotton belt today supports some 3 million tenant farmers, white and black Americans who work the land but do not own it. And for 5 New Deal years into the offices of the cotton belt's U.S. senators,
dear Senator Bankhead, my land won't hardly raise weeds, it's so wore out. My mules can't...
Senator Bilbo, dear sir, the roof on my house is all caved in, and I can't even buy tar to...
Dear Senator Connolly, the bank will not loan me money for seeds unless I grow cotton every year. I think you should know about this, as I'm about to lose my farm.
Such, since the Civil War, has been the plight of the U.S. tenant farmer. Then this week, in a clearing before a weather-beaten two-room shanty near Jasper, Alabama, the neighbors of a tenant farmer witness a ceremony performed by Alabama Senator Lister Hill and tenant farmer Wiley Langley, who stands awkwardly fingering his cap as newsreel cameramen and press photographers record the scene.
Mr. Langley, as a newly elected junior senator from Alabama, it is my privilege to present to you this check from the United States government, the first check to be issued under the Bankhead Jones Farm Tenancy Act. This will enable you to buy the land you are now working, to pay your debts, and rehabilitate your farm.
Thank you very kindly, Senator Hill. I'm right proud to be the first... Well, thank you, Senator.
Dressed in clean overalls, Farmer Langley this week stands before his neighbors to receive the first tenant farmer loan under a government program which will spend $50 million in the next 3 years to enable tenants to buy farms from landlords, reclaim soil worn out by one crop planting, and guarantee farmers a minimum fixed income on his yield. But on the floor of the U.S. Senate,
no one is more stirred by the plight of the tenant farmer than I, Mr. President. But let us look at the government's method. They get a man out of debt to the banks, but they get him into debt to the government.
Mr. President, no farm bill has been passed or is now proposed, which is not voluntary.
Of course, they don't have to borrow from the government. But, gentlemen, what man with human feelings, particularly men under the strain of such hardships as are borne by the southern tenant farmer, what man in such a position can refuse what appears to be a cash bounty given him out of hand by a benevolent government?
This is no cash bounty, sir. It must be repaid.
Will it? Can it ever be repaid? Even now we are asked to vote for this still another farm plan, giving the Secretary of Agriculture dictatorial powers over what a farmer may and may not raise on his land. Gentlemen, the tenant farmer will be relieved of tenancy to his landlord, but he will become the tenant and the servant of his government.
But this week on the tenant farm of Wiley Langley of Jasper, Alabama,
I aim to pay off the landlord, first of all. Then I'm going to tear down this little shack, build a 7-room house, don't leak. Aim to have electric lights. My wife wants a pressure cooker, new hat. We're aiming to give the kids all the lining they can stand. But I guess I'm already getting the best thing a man can ask for. Going out and seeing the sunrise on my own property every morning.
This week, the U.S. Senate supplements the Tenant Farm Bill by passage of a crop control bill. Completes a program which in 5 years has virtually subsidized U.S. agriculture. Leaves to the nation's future the answer to the questions raised by the New Deal's opponents. Questions which the nation's soil may not answer for another 50 years. Time marches on. On the world's news front, women as leaders, as wives of leaders, and as women have in the past 6 days made news.
Women in U.S. politics.
This week in Washington, before the Senate Judiciary Committee, uprises Idaho Senator William E. Borah.
Ladies, this committee has been called to study an amendment to our Constitution. An amendment which would restrain the several states from enacting laws which discriminate against women. It is my hope...
Personally, Senator Borah, I would prefer to call them protective laws. And personally, I think this Equal Rights Amendment is extremely unwise.
Protective laws? They're ridiculous. In New York State, for instance, a woman can't work in an office with men after 2 a.m. It's supposed to be morally dangerous. Why, a woman can be in as much danger at 2 in the afternoon as she can at 2 a.m.
But, ladies, there's a fundamental difference between men and women. A difference that God Almighty made.
Are you suggesting that God is against our amendment, Senator Borah?
I know there are natural reasons why women should not be permitted to engage in hazardous occupations.
Why, Senator, the most hazardous occupation in the world is childbearing.
Well, perhaps I am old-fashioned, ladies, but...
Senator Borah is right. Only the industrially ignorant, the socially muddled...
Who is industrially ignorant? Who is socially muddled?
What does Pauline Newman know about it?
What does Senator Borah know about it?
Please, one at a time, ladies, if you please.
This week, political observers bank heavy odds on the eventual victory of the Equal Rights for Women crusaders. But with congressional committees yet to be heard from, with a two-thirds majority vote of both houses of the U.S. Congress and approval of 36 states required to amend the U.S. Constitution, U.S. women will, for at least another 3 years, be prohibited by laws of the several states from driving taxicabs in Ohio, from running errands in Oregon, from serving drinks in Colorado pool rooms, hewing stone in New York quarries, acting as county medical examiners in Rhode Island, and being the governor of Oklahoma.
Women in Great Britain.
This week in the great throne room of Buckingham Palace, a gangling Lancashire woman strides up the broad red carpet, curtsies before Britain's King George VI and his Queen Elizabeth. She is Gracie Fields, Britain's most popular comedian, highest paid actress in the world.
Grace Fields, it is my pleasure to invest you with this order, first bestowed by my father for distinguished service to the nation, commander of the British Empire.
Your Majesty, Miss Fields, I've wanted to tell you before, we've both enjoyed seeing you at the Palladium so much.
Oh, thank you, Your Majesty. And for the medal, too. It's a wowzer.
We think your music hall turn is a wowzer, too.
Women in official Washington.
This week, the wife of Vice President John Nance Garner gives her annual dinner for the president and official Washington. Employs for after-dinner entertainment famed Manhattan mind reader and hypnotist Joseph Dunninger. In the drawing room after dinner...
Now, Mrs. Roosevelt, I'm going to ask you first to concentrate on some fact or name or idea unknown to anyone else in the room. Just concentrate, and I'll try to figure out what you're thinking.
All right, Mr. Dunninger, I'm concentrating.
I seem to read an initial. The letter J, part of a name. I get two N's, an A.
That's right.
I get the name Jonet, Roberta Jonet.
Yes.
You're thinking of something else. A number.
Yes.
Telephone number. Not a Washington number. I get Poughkeepsie. And three digits. The numbers 70 Poughkeepsie 607.
Why, that's simply uncanny. He read everything in my mind. Mrs. Garner, have him read the vice president's mind.
Oh, no, you don't. It's all right for the women, but we can't have the people reading the minds of statesmen.
This week, reading the mind of husband Jack Garner anyway, famed mind reader Joseph Dunninger finds only the letter J, repeated indefinitely. Reading the mind of Secretary of the Treasury Henry Morgenthau gets the serial number of a $5 bill. Finds in the mind of the nation's most famed husband of any week, Franklin D. Roosevelt, an item chiefly of interest to political prophets of 1940. The address, 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, street and number of the White House. Time marches on.
Manhattan is a thousand cities in one. The sinister, incense-laden atmosphere of Chinatown. Soft Latin voices and a perfume of garlic wafted from the kitchens of Little Italy just beyond. A restaurant of fashion where I pause to chat with Mrs. William Rhinelander Stewart, resplendent in her new pearls. Wave a greeting to Ina Clare, the actress.
Thus, for 23 years, in a column syndicated to 500 newspapers, O.O. McIntyre told the story of Manhattan. Only the close friends of Odd McIntyre knew he seldom saw the celebrities he mentioned so often and so glibly in his column. But he had never seen many of the byways of Manhattan that he wrote about. Only Odd McIntyre's friends knew why he stayed at home with the blinds down, and only ventured through Manhattan in a closed car driven by a chauffeur. And that there was something Odd McIntyre was afraid of. For Odd McIntyre was preserving an illusion and a dream. A dream of a Manhattan that never existed. A dream that 7 million Americans loved to share with him in a daily column that introduced to humble folk in small towns throughout America the celebrities of a glamorous and sinister metropolis. The dream that first became reality for Oscar Odd McIntyre as a small boy in the small town where he himself grew up.
As a child, the companionships of boys and girls had no charm for me. What I liked best was when Grandma would read to me while rocking in the company chair, the one with the crocheted tidy. That was in 1894, Gallipolis, Ohio, when I was 10 years old.
In Gallipolis, Ohio, when Oscar Odd McIntyre was 10 years old.
Julius was more than ever conscious of the rags he was wearing as he looked around the magnificent ballroom, dazzled by the splendor all about him. The ladies sparkling with enormous diamonds and sapphires. Oh, really, Oscar, I can't read any more of this.
Oh, but Grandma.
I don't for the life of me know why Miss Blake gave you such a book to read. All this truck about New York. Not a word of truth in it.
Well, he lived in New York, the man who wrote that book. Why, he saw those things, or why, he couldn't be able to tell about them like that.
Well, everything in books isn't gospel, Oscar.
They got restaurants. They're all crystal and gold. And rich people. Real people. Like the Vanderbilts. All in furs and diamonds. And driving in handsome carriages.
Maybe so. But it isn't all like that. That's just for a few people. Down underneath, it's just a big, dirty town like any other. Just bigger and dirtier than most.
Grandma, I just don't believe you.
This week, as it must to all men, death came to Oscar Odd McIntyre, 54. who never could believe in any picture of Manhattan that differed from the dream of a small boy in Gallipolis, Ohio. Time marches on. One day this week, a special train roars across the Austro-German border along a heavily guarded track, bearing Austria's Chancellor Kurt von Schuschnigg to the little Bavarian village of Berchtesgaden. And to an interview destined to echo through every foreign office of Europe. For 3 hours later, pausing on the terrace of the Villa Berghof to look once beyond the border to Austria, Kurt von Schuschnigg steps quickly into the entrance hall to be greeted by 3 German generals and the Reichsführer, Adolf Hitler.
Herr Dr. Schuschnigg. Hitler. I am happy, Herr Doctor, that you accepted my invitation. We have much to talk over. General Keitel, if you and the others will wait outside for us. Let us go into the study, Herr Doctor, where we can talk undisturbed. For you and I, a great deal. Yes, a great deal.
The doors of Adolf Hitler's study close. As for the first time in his 3 years' dictatorship, pious Austrian Chancellor Kurt von Schuschnigg closets himself on German territory with the Austrian-born Reichsführer, whose dream for Austria is Anschluss. The union of Austria with Germany and its domination from Berlin. The dream of a strong German Mittel Europa stretching from the Baltic to the Mediterranean. Later, still waiting outside the Berchtesgaden study, are Germany's commander-in-chief, the commander of the 2nd Army Corps, and the Munich Air Commander.
Listen. I have heard him angry many times. Never before like this.
Perhaps Schuschnigg refuses.
Refuses?
The Reichswehr would march as one man. It is over.
Very well, Herr Hitler. I shall discuss the matter with my government.
Schuschnigg! I give you 48
this
hours.
This way, Herr Doctor. Yes, thank you, thank you.
Remember, from midnight, I give you 48 hours, no longer.
Such is the ultimatum of Adolf Hitler to Austria's Chancellor. 48 hours to yield the key positions in his government to German-dominated Nazis. 12 hours later in Leipzig, 36 hours before the expiration of Adolf Hitler's ultimatum, at the headquarters of the 4th Army in a company barracks.
Attention! All officers and men of the 4th Army will be ready with full marching equipment to leave barracks beginning 1 hour.
Sergeant, where are we going?
To the Austrian border for special maneuvers.
Everyone out! Hurry!
Hours before the expiration of Adolf Hitler's ultimatum at an army airport near Munich.
Your orders, Lieutenant Hassel.
Yes, sir, Colonel.
Your squadron is to proceed southeastward over the Bavarian Alps to patrol the Austrian border. You are responsible for the section between Reichenthal and the point opposite Salzburg.
Very good, Herr Colonel.
Next, Lieutenant Werner, the Austrian border between Garmisch and Fürth.
One hour before the expiration of Adolf Hitler's ultimatum, over an Austrian government broadcasting station.
Ladies and gentlemen, we regret to interrupt the program. We have been instructed to inform you that the expected government announcement and the outcome of negotiations with Germany has not yet been issued. We beg your patience. You are advised to stay by your radios. We have orders to stay on the air indefinitely until the announcement is made.
Thirty minutes before the expiration of Adolf Hitler's ultimatum, in Vienna's Ballhausplatz, in the Chancellery, a tired man sits at a telephone.
Yes, I understand, Premier Mussolini. Very well. I shall inform President Miklas. No, there's nothing else to be done. Good night, Your Excellency.
Well, Herr Doctor?
Italy has abandoned us.
Well?
We must give them the Ministry of Interior, Justice, Labor. 7 positions in the cabinet. We retain nominal control, of course, but...
For how long?
Who knows? But to avoid bloodshed, invasion, for the present good of Austria.
For the good of Austria. I pray God it may be so, Herr Doctor.
Fourteen years ago in Landsberg prison, an Austrian-born house painter named Adolf Hitler set forth a program in a book entitled Mein Kampf. Since he came to power, Adolf Hitler has rearmed Germany, fortified the Rhineland, all but nullified the Treaty of Versailles, as he promised 14 years ago. This week, in a bloodless coup backed by 80,000 troops massed on the border, Adolf Hitler captures 7 key posts in the Vienna government to dominate Austria, as he promised 14 years ago. And this week, but 3 major points remain on the program of Adolf Hitler. Conquest of the Polish corridor, of Czechoslovakia, and invasion of the wheat fields of the Russian Ukraine. Time marches on. The pageant of the week's news. Memorable scenes from the news of the world you have followed tonight on the March of Time. It is this great news pageant of the world that the magazine Life is unfolding every week before the eyes of its readers in pictures.
Stories and pictures from the week's news front.
Only pictures as Life presents them could tell the story of Washington's latest and bitterest war debate. The dean of American historians calling President Roosevelt's naval policies thoughtless and fantastic. Navy chiefs displaying their preparations for the next war. In Life, you eyewitness a hurricane in California, the year's first dust storms in Oklahoma, and the Alabama home of tenant farmer Langley, who received the first government check under the new farm tenant law.
Life takes you to a jam session.
Life's cameras catch the expressions of pained rapture on girls' faces, the wild-eyed frenzy of men, the abandoned gestures of the Big Apple and the Shag, an hilarious demonstration of young America's mounting passion for swing music.
Life goes to the theater.
Full-color pictures of 3 dazzling Broadway hits of the season. The drama of a neurotic modern mother. The maddest and best musical comedy of the year. And a Greek myth turned into a bedroom farce.
Life portrays an American feudal aristocracy which rules one state of the Union.
Life presents a picture study of the family of the DuPonts. Their homes, their cities, their faces. Takes you behind the scenes to show you how they live. How they dominate the state of Delaware.
These are but a few of the week's news stories which Life's new issue covers in words and pictures.
Life is the only U.S. magazine that pictures the news of the week. With 50,000 more additional copies of this week's issue, U.S. news dealers are now selling far more copies of Life than of any other weekly or monthly magazine. But many news dealers will be sold out by tomorrow night. So to be sure of getting a copy, ask your news dealer for Life tomorrow, Friday morning. Time marches on.